The following program has the potential, dare I say probability, to give offense. It's Tuesday, August 11th, 2020. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. It's Kamala. That is the headline in bold font on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, if it were 1978. As it is 2020, we know not to diminish women by only calling them by their first names. So the Chronicle actually did go with why Kamala Harris was picked as Joe Biden's running mate. A barrier-breaking former California Attorney General and San Francisco District Attorney, Kamala Harris gives Joe Biden a vice presidential candidate with long experience in executive and legislative roles, as well as a prosecutorial sharpness. That was online, not one headline. And it's true. It's all true. Kamala Harris would also be, if elected, as alluded to in the barrier-breaking reference, the first woman to be elected to the presidency or vice presidency and the first black woman elected to either. This is referenced in the very next article in the Chronicle. Spotlight on Kamala Harris exposes solitude of black women at top of politics. It is notable. It is very notable and very important that Kamala Harris is a black woman aspiring to this high office. And if she were to be elected, she would, of course, be the first woman elected to the executive branch. It would shatter, if not the glass ceiling, then the glass drop ceiling. However, as Harris will tell you, she is every bit as much Indian American or South Asian American as she is African American. I think that's notable. I think that's fascinating as well. Her mother was a cancer researcher who died in 2009. Of her, Kamala wrote in her memoir, The Truths We Hold, quote, "There is no title or honor on earth I'll treasure more than to say I am Shyamala Gopalan Harris's daughter." Kamala Harris's parents divorced when she was seven, and her father, Donald, returned to Jamaica. Kamala and her sister would visit him there occasionally in summers after the family moved to Canada. Harris's niece, Mina, told The New Yorker of Donald Harris, quote, "He was not around after the divorce. Their experience and relationship with blackness is through being raised in these communities in Berkeley and Oakland and not through the lens of being Caribbean. Harris's circle was very much African-American. She went to Howard. She attended both black churches and Hindu temples growing up. She is now a black Baptist church member. Her husband is Jewish, by the way." It's all fascinating. And what's extra fascinating to me is if she is elected, she will be the second African-American elected to the presidency or vice presidency after, of course, Barack Obama. But neither of them are African-Americans who were descended from slaves. When Duke professor William Darity was on this show talking about his plan for reparations, it's interesting that under his plan, neither Barack Obama nor Kamala Harris would qualify. It's further interesting that both Obama and Harris's fathers were economists who left the USA and returned to their places of birth to work for the governments of the countries in which they were born. Obama with somewhat limited success in Kenya, Harris to much more success after earning impressive credentials as one of Stanford's economic department's resident Marxists. The economics angle is, I think, mostly a coincidence, but that these two extremely prominent African-American politicians, really perhaps one day the two most prominent African-American politicians, that they are products of the African diaspora in a way that is atypical of the vast majority of African-Americans, that is notable too. I don't know what to make of it. I hope something is made of it. 90% of African-Americans are descendants of slaves. I don't know what it all means, but I would like for it to be further explored in a non-flattening way as an interesting study as to the paths to power of African-Americans and biracial Americans. These are, of course, you know, second or third or maybe 85th day stories. 85 days from now being November 4th, one day after voting occurs, and maybe, though not definitely, on a day when we will know if Kamala Harris makes history, all kinds of history. On the show today, I spiel about the great fan of vigor and athleticism, Donald J. Trump. First time, long time on the Clay Travis Show. But first, President Trump on the 4th of July announced plans for a great sculpture garden to honor Henry Clay, Davy Crockett, Frederick Douglass, Amelia Earhart, Audie Murphy, Patton, Reagan, Jackie Robinson, Betsy Ross, Antonin Scalia, and 20 others. Will it happen? Just a guess on my part, probably not. Could it happen? Meaning, are there even enough sculptors out there to get the job done? This was my question. So we got in touch with Lisi Raskin, who heads the sculpture department at RISD. And as you will hear, the actual question of practicality was met with a qualified probably. But then Professor Raskin and I got into other questions, not of could, but should. And if not an Antonin Scalia sculpture, then what should we be doing with public sculpture in this moment? Is there a way to rethink the guy on the horse model? So it's a different conversation from the one I thought I would have, but it was interesting, and I appreciate Lisa Raskin's perspective, and I hope you do too. Sculpture is in the news, but mostly the tearing down, the objecting to, the what's that doing there in the first place part of sculpture. I wanted to talk about the putting up, the deciding to commission, and some of the practical, theoretical, and artistic choices involved. That's right, a little bit of sculpture talk. Right now, I'm joined by Lisi Raskin, who is the department head of sculpture at the Rhode Island School of Design. Thanks for joining me, Lisi.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Mike. Thank you.
Absolutely. So let me ask you first, you can answer for yourself, and also if you want to give me a sense of your colleagues in the field. When sculptures, when monuments are taken down and maybe even dragged through the street, the recent spate of certain monuments being taken down, oftentimes there are people who were enslavers. Sometimes they are, like in the Wisconsin State Capitol, kind of abstract figures representing freedom or even a abolitionist. Is there an ambivalent feeling in that you have a certain relationship to art, but you also have a certain relationship to, you know, what art should represent and who gets represented in our society? As an artist, when art is destroyed, to some extent, does that cause you any grief?
No, I think it's like a case by case basis, right? Like, I'm pretty interested in abolition, and I'm pretty interested in like the missing subject. So the people whose narratives are just not present from what's happened on this land that we're occupying for the last 500 years. I'm really interested in including like their perspectives and, you know, bringing everybody to the table when we decide whether this thing is good or bad. Like, I'm really interested in what is possible because we got to the point that those monuments fell and people felt compelled to do it. I don't believe that the monuments that fell are like, that they're sacred and should be upheld like regardless of what we're learning. I mean, I'm acutely aware of their ideological function and the way that they perpetuate like a certain sense of history. So I think it's like, it has to do with context. And at this particular moment in time, like for me, it is very important to listen to Black and Indigenous perspectives, period. I know, why would we feel like we have to solve like the next monument problem, right? We're in the middle of the undoing of this notion of monuments and narrative and process and power. If we continue to sort of do this top down, or that the ruling class makes decisions without the input of the people, we're not learning. So there's a question recently around allocation of resources, which I think becomes a really interesting one. So if we're to sort of like tap into a community and we're like, hey, do we need to have monuments here? And people are like, sorry, we would like a public library and like a grocery store that sells food that we can eat. We would like a different thing to happen. I think like that's kind of the promise of now. Like, what do voices in the community want? Like, what does Black and Indigenous leadership want? Like, how can we be in conversation and not sort of rush to use the same tools of the nation state to think that we can simply solve a problem by including everybody who's been excluded from representation?
So there are some empty pedestals now in Richmond and New Orleans. I don't know, maybe around Columbus Circle will just be Circle. We've got these pedestals. Should we rethink the idea of putting anyone up there, even if it's someone who hasn't been represented before? Just the very idea of elevating a person literally above us in, you know, three or four times life size, maybe that's something we should be rethinking.
I mean, I think you're spot on there, Mike. I mean, one of the things that we can really investigate now is like, why do we give so much importance to the individual? And can we give more importance to the collective and to the community? And, you know, what needs to be elevated? I mean, maybe there's a way that something comes and fills in the gap in the sense, I mean, you've seen places like, let's say, like where someone passes away or something beautiful happens and like, you know, the community will come up with candles or flowers or, you know, there are all these other ways that people have of expressing. I mean, maybe it becomes a stage for musicians and like the circle becomes a place to gather in a way that it hasn't been before. And so I think it's kind of like it's exciting because I don't necessarily know the answers, but I do like have a tremendous amount of faith that like we are creative as humans and we can figure out ways to utilize these locations whose meaning and purpose is being changed right before our very eyes.
Do you think that there is almost a ingrained human need or impulse to have that figure, that representative figure high above us, as opposed to some version of, well, I've seen some of the art that you do and it's really provocative or it's really interesting, but sometimes it's abstract and sometimes it's shapes and sometimes it's, you know, looks like lecterns and an American flag and it's interesting to contemplate, but I don't know if it would hold the same place to us as people as the famous figure who is said to be a founder and, or even not the figure, you know, some abstract figure like Manifest Destiny, who is said to be a personification of an ideal. Maybe we as people respond to that in a way we don't some of the other kind of work you're talking about.
You're speaking about like what motivates people. Our brains are porous, like we can be influenced. And so I don't believe that there's an inherent natural inclination to want to see a thing on a pedestal above any one of us. But I believe that reverence for that is taught to us. And I think it's taught to us through these like other instruments of control, like, you know, the nation state, like, you know, the church, for example, the synagogue. I mean, like these are ways where we're sort of taught about hierarchies and authority, and then they create context for us to play out power relationships. So I just think what's super interesting and what I love to grapple with is like, why do we think these things? Like, who told us that, you know, we would need idols or we should worship this or that? And then what like role does that thinking have to do with, I don't know, controlling us or, you know, making us believe in policy or creating ideas that then we hold on to and we take as like neutral or the way that it's always been.
The counterpoint to that would be that it seems like throughout society and throughout history, we have absolutely been driven to the figure on the pedestal, the figure up high that we raise our eyes at and we look at and it looks something like a human being. I can't find too many societies that don't have that. I know that some of your work, you traveled extensively in Afghanistan and you were inspired to create work that is not of that ilk based on those travels. But of course, I think of Afghanistan, you know, they dynamited a couple of gigantic Buddhas because it didn't represent their culture or whatever the Taliban's reasoning would be. But the point is, they were there. I mean, they've been there for thousands of years, the idea of the human-like figure, a bigger than us and higher than us. And so that's what makes me wonder if we've really been taught or if it's ingrained or at least very easy to teach us that.
Oh, I think it is easy to teach us that. But I also, yeah, I mean, so I think they're in Bamiyan was the sculptures of Buddha that you're referring to.
I think there were 100, one was 165 feet high.
Well, that's amazing. And when we think about like a cursory, like understanding, let's say of like historical Buddha or even like historical Jesus, those people in our history or in our mythology or in our religions, they didn't necessarily perceive themselves in the ways that they're being represented, right? So there's like a shift, right? I mean, particularly like Buddha and Christ, it's like who was more like of the people and more humble in the story. So I think it's kind of like the question for us is like, why do we do this? And in fact, just because something is large, does that mean we're supposed to bow down to it? Or for example, is it meant to be, you know, a beacon from far away so that someone can understand that they're moving in the correct direction toward the temple? The partisan monuments or in former Yugoslavia, those are massive. But I think like scale is really informed by lots of different things. It could be the enormity of trauma, an enormous desire to have reconciliation, reparations, like any of these things can be communicated via scale. And it doesn't necessarily have to be on a dominance and subordination register or bowing down to something that has more power than I do. Although, I mean, I believe there are lots of things that have like more power, like the ocean. Like I feel like, you know, particularly cautious and in awe of things like the ocean or, you know, so I think it's kind of like we can really kind of pull this desire, let's say we have to, let's say, be immersed in a kind of vastness and talk about it differently than just the argument that we would inherently want something to kind of be larger than us. You know, these things usually, they're just telling us like what kind of what we should think or how we should act or who's important. And so there are things that are, you know, just not included. So I just wonder, is it constellational or is it intersectional or is it nodal or rhizomatic rather than this one-to-one thing? And I'm certainly not against like figurative representation. I mean,
so rhizomatic is like, it's a botanical term, right?
Yeah. Or even like how, let's say, oak trees are connected via their roots underground. Like this idea that we would be connected by more points than like an us, them or you, me.
Right. Do you think that in practical terms, municipalities could commission grand pieces of art that are nodal or rhizomatic or in different forms than the ones they've traditionally done here in America?
I mean, I think what would be super cool is to like sit down with the people that are making decisions in the municipality, like with the community, and be like, what could do the thing? And how about this? Let's do a rhizomatic, nodal, intersectional, constellational exercise to think about that as an outcome. And then, I mean, I feel like it's definitely complicated.
Right. But then don't you see like that debate at that town council and like four people have that idea and then the other five are like, yeah, how about just the general who led us into war? And then they win.
Yeah, no, I think that there is a real desire to speed things along and to like not have process. And I think if like one thing that I am increasingly more aware of is that I simply can't go as fast as I used to, like because of COVID, like I can't do what I used to. Like in any way. So I think, you know, again, like we're at a really incredibly horrific, but like profound moment where we can act differently. We can comport ourselves differently in relationship to process. We can think less about success and failure, less about completion or less about production than we previously allowed space for, again, in the mainstream.
So I remembered one thing. I wanted to go back and when you were speculating or talking about what the function that perhaps a 1500-year-old Buddha might have, part of it was, as you said, a lodestar to show people and point people to this place of worship. But I also think that those kind of sculptures and even, you know, grand cathedrals in the Middle Ages, part of the point is to say, you know, for an average person who lives his or her life at that time in very, very humble ways to kind of prove the existence of God, to say, without a God, how could we have done this thing? And maybe the people of the time's understanding of that which was miraculous would lead them to think, oh, yeah, that's a pretty good argument. And maybe something like that is going on with the sculptures high on the pedestal of today.
I think you're spot on, Mike. I think that's got a lot to do with the ideological function of, like, you know, memorials. It's like the voice of the state in most cases telling us as, you know, the inhabitants what we should be paying attention to, who's significant and who's powerful and who we should bow down to. Absolutely.
Oftentimes when sculptures are taken down, you'll hear someone say, well, they shouldn't be up. And this is maybe voiced as a compromise solution. And someone will say, well, no, they shouldn't be up in the town square or on the pedestal, but let's put them in a museum.
I feel almost compelled to kind of defer to, let's say, what the Germans did post Second World War, which like was to really rethink monuments. And they have this whole movement against forgetting. And then they make things like the Stasi headquarters, the secret police headquarters, into a museum so that you can learn about what happened there. But I think like predicated in that is like there's a regime change that happens. There's like a massive ideological shift. So I would say that taking down the sculptures and putting them in a museum, but leaving this construct of what we call the United States and all of the systemic oppression inside of it intact is kind of constitutes an empty gesture. All you've done is removed a symbol of a system that's still in place. I mean, I'm also really compelled to think about like all those busts of Stalin or those huge sculptures of Stalin, and they're just kind of in some yard somewhere. I mean, they just got removed and then just like taken out of public view. And I think like that's also like kind of weird. And like, you know, so then what do you have, like a junkyard full of like Stalin busts? What do we want to have happen, really, you know, in the gesture? Or do we want change? Or do we just want it to look like we made change?
Yeah, I have to say, I find that a very compelling argument that the museum to remember only really works if there is a clean break and a clear repudiation. And from what I know of Germany, it seems, yes, there are fascistic elements arising in Germany, but it does seem like at least officially the state was really engaged in that project in a way that Russia post USSR and even Japan wasn't.
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. I mean, like there was a collective shame and a collective reckoning.
Yeah. You know, let us consider what we should be doing with these public spaces and the role of monument sculpture representation in the public square.
I'm super interested in it, and I feel really optimistic about it. And there are like some examples of artists who are already kind of like working in the vein and lending us really just cool ideation toward possibility. There's a sculptor named Raven Chacon, who's from Fort Defiance, Navajo Nation. It's just like making these incredible sound recordings and objects that are instruments that the wind plays. And there's this one piece, it's like singing toward the wind now, singing toward the sun now. And he's just done this thing where basically there's like instruments, and let's say you stumble upon them and all of a sudden you become aware of like the wind, what impact the wind has on metal or strings. And so I think I'm just kind of like, that stuff's blowing my mind in a way, because I'm really interested in conversations around like land and what the land tells us. And I'm interested in conversations around the stories that are told to us and the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that we collectively generate.
I don't know, maybe someday CNN and Time Warner headquarters will be situated at Singing Toward the Wind Circle there on the corner of Central Park.
I would love to imagine that.
Lisa Raskin is the department head of sculpture at the Rhode Island School of Design. This conversation took me to places I did not anticipate, but that is a characteristic of great art. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you, Mike. This was so much fun.
And now the spiel. Don from Jamaica, Queens, you're up next on Sports Talk 760, The Ticket. Your dime, your dance floor, Donnie. NFL season, your thoughts?
Well, they want to open, and they want to open badly, and they've been working with government. I would say this, if they don't stand for the national anthem, I hope they don't open.
Whoa, Donnie. Talking some smack there, coming in hot. No anthem, no football. What kind of fan says that? Really, my man? Okay, what about college football players? Bring it!
These people are so powerful and so strong, and not lots of body fat, although you could take a couple of offensive linemen perhaps and dispute that, but not a lot of body fat, maybe none in some cases, you know, and they're very healthy people. They, you know, people don't realize it's a tiny percentage of people that get sick, and they're old. It just attacks old people, especially old people with bad heart, diabetes, or some kind of a physical problem, a weight problem. Isn't it wonderful that I'm of a perfect physical specimen? It's so great.
Yeah, you're 3% body fat, right?
That's right. I was, 0%. Didn't I have 0%? Somebody said I had 0% body fat. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
But this attacks older people, very viciously, by the way. It can be if it's the wrong person. But, you know, these football players are very young, strong people. And they're physically in extraordinary shape. So they're not going to have a problem. You're not going to see people, you know, could there be? Could it happen? But I doubt it.
Whoa. Going to cut you off there. And thanks for calling. This is a sports show. It is not right for us to give medical information, especially what I think is inaccurate medical information there. People don't turn to your 50,000-watt blowtorch of freedom for this questionable diagnosis. Going to cut you off there. Good call. Call again. Last question. Donald from Queens. Who's better, LeBron James or Michael Jordan?
Well, I've seen them both. Michael Jordan is... Plus, he wasn't political, so people like him better.
Okay. Now, to be clear, you haven't fallen into Sports Talk Radio hell, or as I call it, heck. That was Clay Travis, sports talk host, with guest Donald Trump today. Travis made his name as a sports commentator from an anti-woke perspective. He's not stupid. He's a Vanderbilt Law School graduate, but he is sly. And he saw that there was a niche to criticize big networks like ESPN for not sticking to sports to his satisfaction. He parlayed that into a gig on Fox Sports, where he engages in politics by criticizing the politics of liberal and progressive causes. He also does so under the veneer of claiming not to be political. For instance, here was his response, his toadying response, to Trump picking the apolitical Jordan over LeBron James.
Well, I've seen them both. Michael Jordan is, plus he wasn't political, so people like him better.
That is a perfect answer.
Uh-huh. At one point in the interview, Trump said to Travis, "I don't know what your politics are." Well, Travis was at that moment having the most polarizing political figure in the country on his radio show and lobbing rec league softballs at him. So that might be an indication. This all apparently works and works very well for Trump, who a few weeks ago hosted Dave Portnoy, the head of Barstool Sports at the White House. Portnoy is also anti-woke, anti-progressive, like Travis, a coronavirus, let's say, minimizer. At the White House, Portnoy thought it very important to tell the president this.
So I consider myself, believe it or not, apolitical. I don't consider myself wildly Republican, Democrat, yeah. Kind of down in the middle. In fact, this is my first interview I've ever done. So you, I started at the top.
You started very well. That's good.
But not very apolitical. It's important for the self-perception and self-presentation of these sports figures to profess apoliticality. It also serves the White House's purposes that they can say, hey, look, I'm connecting with this guy who's apolitical. What, by the way, do you call it when it's serving the purposes of the White House and a politician? Whatever it is, it's not apolitical. The presentation of being apolitical, then making the political choice of criticizing other parties for being too political, that is, of course, political. Here, listen to how Clay Travis framed his stance on the return of college football, a stance which the president, as you heard, agrees with wholeheartedly, but also foolheartedly.
I am not trying to pick sides other than being on the side of, I believe college football should be played. Just like I believe kids need to be back in school, K through kindergarten through all the way through college and grad school and everything else. And just like I believe it's time to start to get back to work if you are young and healthy.
That is picking a side. And it's the side the president happens to agree with. It's based on nonsense, but that is the president's side. And if it wasn't your side, Clay, and if you weren't on the side of the president, then the president wouldn't be on your show. And furthermore, this apolitical stance, which the Pac-12 and Big Ten thus far disagree with, it is the epitome of political. I'm not picking a side. I just want to compel unpaid athletes to perform for my entertainment. I don't know, maybe it is apolitical because politics is forced by other means, and it seems here that the means are literally forcing these athletes to play. I could care less about the sincerity or awareness of the professed apolitical stance of two particular sports figures. But there is a whole audience that regularly regales us with the stick to sports decree, and they, most of them will say, well, I'm apolitical, but they also almost all support Trump, and they almost all hate Colin Kaepernick, and they almost all think that a Blue Angels flyover honoring our troops is apolitical, but the declaration of Black Lives Matter in a similarly prominent place on a basketball court is terribly political. Now, thankfully, even the apolitical among us are scared and motivated and appalled by the coronavirus, so that could affect the election. But saying you're apolitical today, in these times, at this moment, is like saying, I'm indifferent, I'm blasé, or even, I'm too stupid to have an informed opinion. Adhering to a claim of being apolitical, but putting tons of effort into proving that you're apolitical, and doing it to appeal to the president and to placate your President Trump-loving audience, the words I would use for that are words like strategic, purposeful, dishonest, disingenuous. It is, in short, an extremely political act. And that's it for today's show. Daniel Schrader and Margaret Kelly produced The Gist. They, along with Alicia Montgomery, who is the executive producer of Slate Podcast, were considering doing a live show. But then a very wise person told them,
"You can't have one seat and then seven around that seat, sir, have to be empty. Oh, that'll look great. You know, you have one person and everything's fake empty around him. You can't do that."
But you do have to appreciate him calling you sir. The Gist. Our modal is nodal and our genome is rhizome. Oompa-ra-deppa-ra-doo-peru. And thanks for listening.